Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In their new book, 2024, How Trump Retook the White House and the Democrats Lost America, today's guests, award-winning reporters Tyler Pager and Josh Dossey, ask, how did the first U.S. president to become a convicted felon regain control of the White House, and at what cost? Where did the Biden and Harris campaigns go wrong? They write, Trump had redefined the Republican coalition and created an existential crisis for the Democratic Party. He'd promised to pardon January 6th rioters, round up and deport millions of immigrants, start trade wars with allies, use government power to punish his critics, purge law enforcement agencies to install personal loyalists, relocate homeless people to tent cities, eliminate government agencies, give his biggest donors free rein to slash federal spending, even act as a dictator, if only for a day. And America said, okay, almost every county shifted right. He improved with almost every demographic. He even won the popular vote. The book 2024 is based on hundreds of interviews with the people closest to the Trump, Biden, and Harris campaigns. And today we're joined by two of the book's three authors. Tyler Pager is White House correspondent at the New York Times and a former reporter at the Washington Post. Josh Dossey is an investigative reporter for the Wall Street Journal and also a former reporter at the Washington Post. Hi, Josh and Tyler. Thank you so much for your work on this and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Well, it's great to have you. Great to have you both. Tyler, can you start off by talking about how you all did this extensive reporting? Because you have so much behind the scenes information. How did you go about it?
Yeah, so this project started when the three of us were colleagues at the Washington Post. I was covering the Biden White House and campaign, and Josh and Isaac were covering Donald Trump and the Republican Party and the primary that was, unfolding. And we felt uniquely positioned to deliver what we wanted to be the definitive and consequential, the definitive and comprehensive story of the 2024 election. And so we started this in the summer of 2023 and reported it all the way up through basically March of this year, and spoke to, as you said, hundreds of people on all three campaigns in the White House, and voters and strategists around the country. And it took a lot of time, but that's why three of us worked on this together, because as you said, we wanted to pack it with reporting and behind the scenes, fresh insights that readers couldn't get anywhere else.
What would you add, Josh, because you all have so much information about conversations that were had, how decisions were made about how Harris would talk about Gaza, for example. I mean, we just heard that horrific news from the BBC headlines about what's happening in Gaza. You've got really incredible information about Biden calling Harris and basically saying, people are afraid that you might be criticizing me too much. And remember, I'm very popular in Pennsylvania. So you've got so much inside information here. Can you talk more about how you got this?
Yeah, well, over the course of the reporting for this book, which really stretched almost a couple of years, we did the intensity of the reporting after the election in a few months, but we began reporting the book in 2023. We talked to, more than 300 people for the book, including, top folks on all three campaigns. And the goal was to sort of building blocks to take information and more information and more information and kind of use that to get even more people to talk to us. And I think by the end, we were pleased with the amount of new details we were able to emerge to the public.
In the beginning of the book, in the point of no return chapter, you talk about what happened when the FBI searched Mar-a-Lago, and you write that Trump was stunned. The club was closed for the seasons. No one was around. What was the FBI doing there? What were they taking? Trump's legal team did not have the answers. He called his lawyers. He called his adult children. Can you talk about the role that that search played in Trump deciding to run again for president?
Sure. I mean, in some ways, it was a predicament of his own making. He had taken the classified documents from the White House. His own lawyers had tried repeatedly to get him to return them. They told them, the FBI or National Archives could come for them. Trump was stubborn and went to sort of extraordinary methods and means to evade cooperating, even with a subpoena. And so in August 2022, the federal authorities showed up and they went through Mar-a-Lago and they found all sorts of top secret and classified documents, some about nuclear weapons, all sorts of military documents, sort of interspersed with news clippings and all sorts of things that were less sensitive, right? And in that moment, Trump faced pretty extraordinary criminal peril. He had the investigation in New York that ended up, obviously, with him being charged and convicted of felonies there. He had the classified documents case. He had the investigation around Jan 6 and sort of his false claims about stealing an election and the efforts to overturn the election, that culminated in the violent events at the Capitol. And there was a lot really piled up quickly on him. And one of the things that we sort of heard from, multiple people around him in that period is that them searching Mar-a-Lago really made him, in his own words, in an interview he did with me for the book, more resolute to run. And that previously he was thinking about it and sort of toying with it. But that when they searched his house in August of 2022, he sort of realized what existential stakes he had going forward. And I think it really propelled him to announce.
Right. You interviewed Trump at Mar-a-Lago when he said that this made me more resolute. You talked to Doug Deason, a Republican donor close to the Trump family, who said he was not going to run until the FBI raided Mar-a-Lago. He was pissed. He was stunned. He was going to run and he was going to clean house at the DOJ. Another longtime aide said he saw the campaign as running for his freedom. In reading the book, Josh, it's so easy to forget just how many lawsuits he was dealing with, convictions and trials he was dealing with. I mean, you have this one scene during the trial in New York, and the jury came back so quickly, and they just said, and I kind of almost forgot about this, guilty, 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 32 times. The word guilty was repeated. And you all write, he still faced other trials on classified documents and attempting to overturn the 2020 election. His advisors increasingly saw winning in November as his only way to stay out of prison.
Well, one of the things we uncovered in the book was what a sophisticated strategy he had for some of these cases. I think at the time covering them, I saw his pugilism and sort of his raw, visceral anger just to be kind of lashing out. But really, what we sort of saw in totality is that he had a legal team who their entire strategy was delay every case at every turn for as long as they can, while he sort of undercut prosecutors publicly and turned part of the country against him, and while he mounted his campaign. And by the end of all of these trials, I mean, if you look what happened on January 6th, I think it was pretty widespread the view that, they tried to overturn an election. It was a violent event at the Capitol. What happened that day was profoundly horrible. I think even Republicans were saying that, right? If you look at the classified documents, a lot of folks in the Senate, a lot of Republicans, thought he should have taken those classified documents and should have given them back. On the various cases, he had real significant problems. And one of the things I think we saw was that through both him and his lawyers, he sort of clawed his way back by undercutting all of these cases.
And Tyler, the other thing that was so interesting to learn in your book is a lot of people wonder, why would Trump supporters still back him, given these convictions, given these cases, given January 6th? And you have this section in the book, in the section Inevitable, about how the DeSantis campaign was trying to bring down Trump. And this was so interesting to learn about what the research showed about his voters, about Trump voters. Voters might agree with a position in the abstract, But when the moderators identified Trump with the opposite position, those same voters would switch sides to realign with him. Test ads that contrasted Trump's position with another candidate's position backfired because voters viewed it as an attack on Trump. Trump's opponents were so desperate that nothing was off limits. One DeSantis-aligned operation sent mail pieces to Christian conservatives in Iowa purporting to praise Trump as a supporter of gay marriage and trans rights. Even if they could find the right line of attack, some Republican strategists and ad makers told donors they would not work on anti-Trump efforts because the campaign would retaliate. And then this was also interesting. As DeSantis stumbled when he was running against Trump, Senator Rick Scott reconsidered his decision not to join the primary. He too commissioned research looking for Trump's weaknesses. In one focus group, when Trump supporters were shown the facts about his shortcomings on building a border wall, one woman explained that Trump must have done that on purpose in order to funnel the migrants through gaps where they could be apprehended more readily, and Scott decided to stay out of the race. Can you tell us more about this? I mean, this is just fascinating information about Trump loyalists.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've seen the way in which Trump has, you know, recreated the Republican coalition almost in his image. And I think many of the Republican candidates struggle to figure out ways to attack him, in part because voters were so attached to him as their leader. And I think there's, you know, we've seen that over the course of his political career. He has a latitude with voters that almost no other political figure has had in recent American political history. I mean, you know, even as he sometimes changes positions or reverses course as president, his supporters are giving him wide latitude. I think some of that is being tested at the current moment as it relates to the sort of frustration from some of his most ardent supporters over his administration's handling of the Epstein files. But just looking back at the campaign, I think it's very clear that there is a certain part of the Republican base that was going to vote for Donald Trump no matter what.
What do you think explains that, Josh?
The amount of people that would vote for him no matter what?
Just the fact that they're so loyal that they will change their own views based on, I mean, it was just so interesting to read about this opposition research, and so much of it just didn't land.
Well, I think part of it, Rose, is that they just trust him more than they trust the media or any institutions or any sort of other aspects of American life. I mean, part of the book that I thought was most, in some ways, most interesting was on abortion, right? Mm-hmm. Trump had sort of put the Supreme Court judges there to overturn Roe v. Wade, and it's sort of taken all sorts of positions over the years on the cases. But no matter what happened, like, his supporters sort of gave him the altitude to keep going. And other politicians, I think, would have had, you know, to been twisted in knots, sort of trying to explain their contradictory positions or changing positions, and he just wasn't, right? And he has a bond with his supporters that is unlike any other politician I have seen or covered, in that when he tells them, you know, something, they really believe it. And the DeSantis folks, other candidates as well, put, you know, all sorts of different opposition research. They would sit in these focus groups, right, where they could watch dozens of voters, and they would say things to them, and they would say, well, Trump said X, Y, Z. And the people would say, oh, no, he didn't say that. He would never say that. And then they would sometimes play, you know, the clip and say, listen, well, here it is, right? And the people would say, well, that's not what he meant. He really meant blah, 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 blah. And it's just, it's a rationalization for him that I don't think anyone else in the Republican or Democratic Party has. There's a real, like, bond and give him the benefit of the doubt. And I think part of that is because he's been effective over the last decade at always being the martyr and the victim, right? Playing the role of the martyr and the victim, raising money off of it, always saying that he's under attack. Everything that's happened to him is so unfair. Can you believe all of these people are attacking me the way they are? And so I think in the eyes of a lot of his supporters, if something bad is happening to him or he's being criticized for something, their first reaction now is to say, that's BS, basically.
Well, Josh Dossi is investigative reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Tyler Pager is White House correspondent at the New York Times. And they wrote this new book, 2024, with Isaac Arnsdorf, who covers the White House for the Washington Post. The book is called 2024, How Trump Retook the White House and the Democrats Lost America. It's based on hundreds of interviews with the people closest to the Trump, Biden, and Harris campaigns. They have so much information in here about how decisions were made, what went on behind the scenes. If you have any questions for today's guests, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Josh, since you brought up abortion, let's spend some time on this because this is another very interesting part of your book. And, you just reminded me about misinformation and where people get their information. So the polling shows, especially after Roe was overturned, that support for abortion rights increased in this country. Some polls show it's 70%. And in May of last year, the New York Times ran a piece that found nearly one in five voters in battleground states said that Biden was responsible for ending the right to an abortion. Despite the fact that while he wasn't comfortable talking about abortion, you also write about that in your book, he did support abortion rights, and Trump was the one that appointed the justices who made it possible to overturn Roe. So can you talk about what went on behind the scenes where you had some people in the Republican Party wanting Trump to embrace a national ban, and others knew, including Trump, that that would be political suicide? And that's when he said, we've got to let the states decide.
Right. So when Roe v. Wade was overturned, which had been a Republican Party sort of ideological crusade for 5 decades, you would expect that the president would have been happy about this, right? Because his judges did it and it was sort of something that his party wanted forever. But he was not. In fact, he turned to his advisors, as we recount in the book, and said, we're screwed. He maybe used a more profane word that I won't say here on air. But he realized immediately that abortion was going to be a huge problem for him. And in the midterms in 2022, Democrats used abortion to perform better than a lot of folks expected. It's one of the reasons that Joe Biden kept running for president. We can talk about that more later. But abortion was sort of a key issue there. And Trump realized that Democrats were going to spend hundreds of millions of dollars with abortion ads and saying how he took women's rights away and, all of the rest. And he and his team basically viewed mitigating those attacks as the number one political priority in the year, 2023 and early 2024. So when folks like Kellyanne Conway and Senator Lindsey Graham and a lot of the pro-life groups like Susan B. Anthony were pushing Trump to embrace a 15-week national ban, saying at least, nothing after 15 weeks anywhere, Trump was sort of reticent and he didn't really want to do it. And folks on his team put together all of his research showing him that if he did this, that abortion, he would get attacked in all of these states for making the laws more restrictive than the states already were, particularly in these Rust Belt states that he needed to win. And so Trump decided, basically for political purposes, not to embrace any sort of national standard and to sort of leave it to, quote unquote, in his words, states' rights. And that position, coupled with the way his campaign talked about abortion, really had a lot of voters by the end forgetting that his Supreme Court, the nominees he put on the court, overturned Roe v. Wade and what he had said about abortion in the past. And I think his team was successful from a political sense of taking that issue and, while not taking it off the table completely, bringing down the vulnerability that he had on it through the moves they made in 2023 and early 2024.
Right. And in the book, you write about this presentation given to Trump called How a National Abortion Policy Will Cost Trump the Election. Tyler, I remember seeing interviews with young women on college campuses who said they were pro-choice, but that they were voting for Trump.
Yeah, I think abortion was an issue that was much more complicated than meets the eye. I think in 2022, we saw Democrats really powered to victory in large part because of abortion. And I think that was not the case as much in 2024. And in part, one of the interesting dynamics at play here was that there were many battleground states that had abortion referendum on the ballot. So voters could go into the ballot box and feel like they were protecting reproductive rights by directly voting for a constitutional amendment or whatever the process was in their state to ensure they had reproductive rights, and at the same time, vote for Donald Trump.
Well, we're getting a few emails, and a lot of listeners would like you to talk about the Democrats and the economy. Wayne writes, the Democrats seem deaf to the concerns of everyday people's concerns about inflation, especially increases in food prices. Biden's response was to tout his Bidenomics, which most people could care less about. Modern Democrats seem to be no longer the FDR party who focuses on the problems of the common people, perhaps because more and more of them are taking donations from corporate America. So you write a lot about this, about Biden's economic message and how he was surprised that the message was not sticking. And yet at the same time, so many people in this country were just struggling to make ends meet. So can you talk about what you learned from the people you interviewed when it comes to, well, we'll talk about before what happened before Biden dropped out and his economic message.
Yeah, the economy was an issue that bedeviled the Democrats for Biden's entire presidency. Biden came into office, with the pandemic raging and passed the economic stimulus bill. And then as the economy started to open up, as the pandemic receded somewhat, it became, pent-up demand led to inflation. And Democrats were trying to defend against criticisms from Republicans that they had overheated the economy with that stimulus package. And so the challenge that Biden's aides saw was they wanted to get credit for their work on the pandemic and reopening the economy, but were also concerned about the criticism that, prices were still elevated and voters kept saying we're not happy with the economy. And so we talked to many people in Biden's orbit, and one of the things that they said was they felt they needed to tell the positive story of the economy and the efforts that they made to reopen the economy. And so the challenge with that was that many voters were not feeling that. The voters wanted more empathy. The voters wanted more action to reduce the price of groceries and gas. And that created this dynamic where many voters felt Democrats were not eating their concerns, were too focused on touting their economic benefits and not concerned enough on their challenges.
When you spoke with the Biden and Harris campaigns, did you hear people talking about poverty in this country, about people struggling to make ends meet? I mean, according to the Poor People's Campaign, there are 140 million poor and low-income people in the United States. And we've been doing a lot of shows about Medicaid cuts. 71 million people in this country are enrolled in Medicaid. You know, this is a healthcare program for low-income people. So many people in this country struggle to make ends meet. When you were interviewing the campaigns, did you hear them talk much about all of these people and their needs?
I mean, I think there was obviously a lot of focus on inflation and the price of living and affordability. We saw that on both sides of the campaign. There's this sort of iconic scene where Trump has a press conference at one of his clubs, and it's filled with all different household goods. And his aides want him to go out there and talk about how the price of meat and cereal and other items have risen since Biden was in office. And, Biden and Harris also struggled with that same sort of challenge. In terms of specifically, the Poor People's Campaign and those issues, I think there was a desire to try to elevate those issues and talk about it. I think one of the things that, Harris and Biden really struggled on was how to talk about it. One of the scenes we have in the book is that during Harris's debate prep, where she's preparing to debate Trump, the issue of the economy keeps coming up and how to discuss it. And they say, you know, her aides, we'll come back to it. We'll tackle that later. And they just really never figure out how to settle on an economic message. And obviously that was something that hindered Democrats in the election.
And can you elaborate on that? Why was it so difficult for them to come up with an economic message? That's the other thing. Your book really goes into how after the Trump-Harris debate, the needle really didn't move. And the Harris campaign was really struggling to come up with a message. What explains that?
I think it's a few things. One is that they were having trouble both touting the work that they had done on the, I think they were struggling with the balance. How do you try to get credit for legislation you had passed that you felt had delivered results for the American people, while also acknowledging that people were not feeling great about the economy? And that's something that Trump hammered over and over again, or at least his campaign really spent a lot of their money on ads and messaging around the economy because they felt that was a winning issue. And the Biden-Harris orbit really struggled with that balance of acknowledging that people were really in pain. And one of the things that, you know, we capture is the pollsters working on the Biden-Harris campaign tried to make that case, tried to make the case to Biden and his team that they needed to address this gap, the gap of the people who were really feeling the pain of high prices and the affordability crisis that many in this country have long complained about.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. And after the break, I'd love to ask you both about some new research out about why, and I had to read this three times because it's really hard to comprehend, why 19 million people who voted in 2020 did not vote in 2024. And there's some new polling out about this that is directly connected to what you write about in your book. Today, we're joined by Tyler Pager, White House correspondent with the New York Times, Josh Dossie, investigative reporter at the Wall Street Journal. We're talking about their new book, 2024, How Trump Retook the White House and the Democrats Lost America. This book is based on hundreds of interviews with the people closest to the Trump, Biden, and Harris campaigns. If you have any questions for our guests, any comments, just looking back at what happened last year, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on our media roundtable tomorrow, we'll discuss the GOP's efforts to redraw congressional maps to tighten their grip on the House and next year's midterms. And then we will talk about Gaza's deepening hunger crisis. According to the UN, Gaza's entire population is experiencing prolonged food shortages. Nearly 500,000 people are facing a catastrophic situation. I hope you can join us tomorrow. And then we are going to talk with today's guests and about what they found about Harris and Biden and Gaza for their new book, 2024, How Trump Retook the White House and the Democrats Lost America. Tyler Pager is White House correspondent with the New York Times. Josh Dossie is an investigative reporter at the Wall Street Journal. They are both former award-winning reporters with the Washington Post. Just to add a little bit more about the economy, I'm not sure if you both have seen this, but The American Prospect had a piece a couple days ago by Robert Kuttner, and there's new polling out by Celinda Lake, And this was conducted for the group Way to Win. And they wanted to find out why 19 million people who voted in 2020 sat out in 2024. That still seems like such a major, major number. Of course it is. So 49% said they would have voted for Harris compared to 25% for Trump. A majority of these disaffected non-voters hold progressive views on the economy. On pocketbook issues, most of these people are economic progressives, and they said that Harris failed to address deeper issues like poverty and inequality. 15% said she did not have the leadership qualities the country needed. What are your thoughts about these findings? And either of you can take this one.
Sure, I'll take this one. Well, there was deep disillusionment on the Democratic side with Biden and then with Harris too, to some degree on Gaza and Israel, with a lot of folks thinking that Biden had been too stridently supportive of Netanyahu and the Israeli regime. There were a lot of folks on the Democratic side who did not think that the Biden administration's economic message was working for them. I think some of that also kept going with Harris. And there were also people, Tyler had a lot of reporting about this for our book, who just did not think the party should have nominated Biden again, who thought he was too old, he was a bad candidate. And we got some interesting numbers where on the Democratic side, the small dollar fundraising had gone down significantly. Volunteers, people who'd be willing to go out and knock on doors and participate in the election, was down significantly. People just were not excited about what the party was offering them. I think on the Republican side, it's a little bit different in that Trump's most sort of ardent supporters would come out no matter what, right? And what he did is, instead of, we have some memos in the book that outline how this worked, but instead of looking for, you know, suburban women and for independent voters and for others who, you know, maybe had drifted away from him, they just went for running up a score with men and running up a score with folks who, you know, were big Trump fans. It was less about trying to persuade new people to come out, but to try and get more of the people who were already with him to actually vote. And they called these low propensity voters. And so they had a different tactic. And I think theirs worked in a different way because they were looking at different people. And one of the biggest challenges for the Democratic side was that the voters and the grassroots folks, they just didn't give them much to be excited about in the campaign. And, you know, a lot of people said they were going to stay home over the Israel-Gaza issue. I was talking to Debbie Dingell, the congresswoman in Michigan, who was telling me how many folks in Dearborn were saying to her, you know, we're going to vote for Trump, or we're not going to vote at all. And she said, I don't think that's in your interest. And they did anyway.
Right. And in your book, you write that for months, Kamala Harris had been privately telling her aides that, you know, she was concerned about the plight of Palestinians and how Biden was handling the issue. Shortly after that meeting, she delivered a major speech on Israel, echoing Biden's call for Hamas to accept a ceasefire and going slightly further than he had in describing the situation in Gaza as a humanitarian catastrophe and urging Israel to allow in more aid. You also have information about what happened at the Democratic convention. You write that convention organizers invited the parents of an American hostage held in Gaza to speak. Many in the party's left wing demanded a speaking slot for someone of Palestinian descent. Some of Harris's top aides did not want a Palestinian speaker on stage, a view bolstered by the national security apparatus at the White House, who worried about how the speech could undermine Biden's diplomatic efforts. Others thought the storyline was more damaging than the reality, and some even suggested having a taped speech to minimize risks. Jamie Harrison, the party chair, expressed concern that rejecting a Palestinian speaker would hurt Harris politically. He was told the vice president would address the conflict, but the Palestinian cause went unrepresented on the main stage, and then protests rang out outside. Is there anything else you'd like to add to that one, Tyler, about what you all learned about how Gaza was talked about behind the scenes?
Yeah, I think it was a complicated issue, in part because there was vast disagreements within the party and within the White House even about how to address both the diplomatic efforts and the sort of posture toward Israel, and also how to address the voters' concerns and the divides within the Democratic Party were real and remain real. And so I think, you know, there was substantive differences and also stylistic differences. And I think that's really where we saw the sort of break or attempted break between Biden and Harris. But the challenge for Harris was she had a very tight time window and she was still the sitting vice president. Biden was still the president. And there was pressure for her to stay aligned with Biden on this very issue. She tried to, you know, take a little bit of a different tone, especially towards Netanyahu and his leadership of Israel in the war. But at the end of the day, there wasn't really a significant break with Biden that would have pulled in some of those people that were deeply critical of how the Biden administration was handling the conflict. At the same time, there were strategists working on the campaigns who said that Harris had more to lose if she did break with Biden, with some of the people who were supportive of Biden's approach. So there was not a consistent set of advice or even agreement among the people working on the campaign as it related to this issue.
We also learn in your book, 2024, that on the afternoon of the Harris-Trump debate, Harris took a call from Biden. He wanted to share concerns that some of his friends were questioning her loyalty to him because of the way she was campaigning. He framed the concerns as political advice, warning that he remained popular in Pennsylvania and efforts to distance herself from him could hurt her in the critical battleground state. At the staff level, Biden's aides conveyed to Harris's aides that the VP should do whatever she needed to win, essentially giving the campaign license to break with Biden. But Harris felt Biden saw it differently and his comments annoyed her. And, you know, that led to so much attention after that interview on The View when she was asked if she would do anything differently. And she basically said no. And the Trump campaign ran with that.
Yeah, I mean, that was a huge ad for the Trump campaign and sort of helped them crystallize their message that Harris was a continuation of Biden. But two things to your point there. One is that was not the answer Harris was supposed to give, even though she was frustrated by the conversation she had with Joe Biden where he made those comments. Her aides had rehearsed with her a different line that wasn't a substantive break, but one that sort of captured that captured she was a different person. She was supposed to say, you know, I come from a different generation. I have a different set of views. I'm not going to criticize the president, but also not just say she agreed with everything he said. And then as it related to that conversation, I mean, one of the things to recall at the time is that Biden dropped off the presidential ticket because he was not popular. And so even him telling Harris that he was popular was just not exactly true.
Today, we are talking about the new book, 2024, How Trump Retook the White House and the Democrats Lost America. Tyler Pager is White House correspondent at The New York Times. Josh Dossi is investigative reporter at The Wall Street Journal. Their book is based on hundreds of interviews with the people closest to the Trump, Biden, and Harris campaigns. Let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Dell in Oakland. Hi, Dell. Thank you for holding.
Good morning. What I find really interesting is when I talk to Trump supporters, they have the common theme is they don't trust the government, and they want less government control. But what I found extremely interesting is that they would have voted for Bernie Sanders, who was going, you know, against lobbyists and also trying to tone down corporate control.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. Josh or Tyler, any thoughts on that?
Well, a lot of Trump supporters do not neatly fit, as she said, in the sort of ideological pantheon as it would be viewed traditionally. They, you know, culturally with him on certain issues, he's taken sort of issues all over the map. And it's more of a outsider versus insider game, I think, in some ways, than sort of a traditional right versus left game. And even though Trump, in a lot of ways now, is a consummate insider, I don't think, as our reporting has shown, he's drained the swamp. I don't think he's done a lot of the things that he said as an outsider he was going to do to change Washington. A lot of his supporters still see him as an outsider and a fighter and someone taking on interest for them, just like maybe they probably see, a Bernie Sanders among a certain population. So I do think there's something to the idea that candidates like Trump and Bernie Sanders attract a kind of a certain kind of person that just dislikes the system as a whole.
In fact, Tyler, your colleague, Claire Kane Miller, wrote a piece in December about this, how some voters moved from Bernie to Donald Trump. And she quoted Joshua Dyack, a political science professor at the University of Massachusetts Lowell, who said, "The connective tissue from Trump to Sanders is something akin to populism. The ruling class sucks, and that rhetoric plays well among a certain class of people who do not feel the government works for them. The politics of anti-elite grievance is not just popular in the US, and it's not just popular on the right. It's the story of politics right now." And yet, Trump says that he's anti-elite and anti-establishment. I mean, but we know, I mean, based on so much, that he's anything but. I mean, you've got this really interesting scene in your book about how Trump entertained two lobbyists at a dinner from Reynolds American who wanted him to oppose a looming Biden administration ban on menthol-flavored cigarettes. The tobacco lobbyists brought extensive material to make their case and campaign checks. Trump never liked smoking, but he told them he liked their pitch better than that of oil CEOs he recently met with. He said, quote, "They badmouth their own products because of global warming. F that, we need oil. What the F? That's your business. You're basically shooting yourself in the foot." So how do you think Trump has been able to get away with saying that he's kind of a populist like Bernie? And yet, I mean, you saw what happened at Mar-a-Lago when you were there, Josh. Lobbyists, incredibly wealthy people wanting to give me a favor, I'll give you a check. How has he been able to get away with that?
Well, Trump has done more in the past couple of years of taking huge checks from moneyed interests than probably any politician in decades, if ever, right? And you're right on the tobacco guys and the other folks on the campaign. They would come to Mar-a-Lago at a Bedminster to Trump Tower and have dinner with him and cut, millions and millions of dollars of checks for his PAC, his super PAC, his other related efforts. And a lot of them got what they wanted, on the second day of the administration, right? The tobacco guys got what they wanted. He in this campaign was pretty transactional, even by his standards in the past. He became pretty audacious fundraiser, promising folks all sorts of things who were contributing to his campaign. And, asking, for example, we reported at Mar-a-Lago, the all CEOs and billionaires to raise $1 billion for his campaign and said, basically, it will be cheaper for you to do that than what Biden's policies would cost you. This was when Biden was still in the race. Now he's still doing it. He's doing lots of fundraisers as president at his clubs where he's charging one, two, $3 million from a lot of crypto folks, cryptocurrency executives, and others who come. And he's not really that shy-ish or, isn't doing that even much to hide it, frankly. And his voters seem to, supporters seem to still view him in some sense as the outsider.
This was another incredible scene in your book, 2024. Trump told nursing home representatives that they were going to get effed by the Biden administration regulations on staffing. He served them well-done steak and asked for millions more than they'd originally planned to give. He was very explicit when he asked billionaires for more money. In our remaining minutes, I'd love to ask you both about what you found out about media and how the campaigns dealt with this new media environment we're in. It was interesting to learn that Kamala Harris actually had a hard time going on non-political shows. So both of the campaigns knew that they wanted to reach low-information voters. And I mean, I don't really like that phrase, but it's basically people who don't spend that much time, reading political books and watching cable shows and reading about politics. And they really wanted to reach these people. Tyler, why did the Harris campaign have such a hard time going on these shows?
Yeah, I think that's one of the success stories for the Trump campaign and the Republican Party was their ability to reach people outside of traditional media channels that, you know, campaigns spend hundreds of millions of dollars with paid advertising. And there was this whole ecosystem of podcasts that were eager to have President Trump on, Joe Rogan, Theo Vaughn, those sorts of podcasts, whereas the equivalent of podcasts that would reach maybe softer Democratic voters or Democratic voters that weren't following political news all the time, just weren't interested in having Kamala Harris on. They basically said, we don't do politics. We do sports or we do food or we do culture, but politics is off limits for us. And so there's many podcasts that we write about in the book that Harris's campaign asked if they would have her on, and ultimately they didn't. Rogan would have had her on. There was a scheduling snafu, and ultimately Kamala Harris sat for an interview with Brené Brown. And as one aide said to us after that, you know, just about as far as possible from what Rogan and the audience he has.
And the Trump campaign really was going after white men in this effort. And I mean, they were able to break through with so many people that most of us have probably never heard of. There were ultimate fighting podcasts, YouTube people, pranksters who sold clothes, but these people had millions of viewers and they were able to do this when they could easily bypass the traditional media because we're in a new media environment now. I also wanted to ask you both what you learned about how both campaigns thought about and went after men of color, specifically Latino men and Black men. We don't have much time, but this was also a very interesting part of your book. What did you learn and what stands out for you?
Well, the gender gap was real. And I think what the Trump campaign realized was that it was true they were going to lose with women voters by large percentages, but they believed that on the flip side, they could win with men voters by even larger percentages. And so much of the campaign was about attracting male voters, from the podcast, as you just said, to him attending all sorts of sporting events, UFC matches, football games, tailgates, to the way they spent money on advertising. So much of it was about, I mean, I don't think it can be overstated how much a campaign was about winning men. And Trump and his campaign said that they were going to target, you know, Latino men and Black men. And there were folks, critics, I think some in the media, some in sort of even the Republican Party, who thought that he would really struggle to do that, given his rhetoric in the past and things that he had said and done. But if you look at the numbers, and numbers sort of don't lie, he really won larger percentages of those voters than Republicans have in the past. He certainly didn't win, you know, a majority, but won a much bigger percentage to make it significantly and substantively a game changer in a way. And one of the things that they did, particularly in the final months of the election, was, you know, highlight a lot of cultural war issues, particularly, you know, transgender issues, talking about, you know, that Kamala Harris in the past had said that she supported taxpayer gender reassignment surgeries. They just spent weeks and weeks and weeks spending tens of millions of dollars hammering that on every chance they could get. And the goal was to make Kamala Harris less appealing to those groups, where even if they didn't vote for Trump, they would at least stay home. And I think in some ways, whether you like or dislike Trump, they were pretty efficient at what they were trying to accomplish.
We have an email from Peter who says the Democratic base mostly stayed home in disgust over the neocon party's leadership and disregard for the economic plight of the working class. Another listener says, what has the Democratic Party learned from all of this? What are your thoughts on that? Because with Zohran Mamdani's win in New York City, there's another fight in the Democratic Party about the way forward. And Celinda Lake, who just did this polling about why so many people stayed home, told the American Prospect that the Democrats need to offer a populist economic alternative, fight for working families, and offer specifics you're willing to be accountable for. Tyler, were you able to talk about this in your interviews? What is the way forward for the Democratic Party?
I think that's up for debate. And that is what we will see, you know, sort of fought over the next 2 to 4 years as Democrats try to settle on a midterm message. And then we launch into what is expected to be a very crowded Democratic primary. And I think in that primary, we will see people representing different paths forward, whether that's more to the left, more to the center, and also variations in between on specific issues. We are seeing a lot of Democrats call for economic populism. We're seeing a lot of Democrats call for generational change and a push to maybe it doesn't have to be ideologically different, but just from a different generation of younger leaders, more diverse leaders. So I think those are the exact questions a lot of Democrats are asking, and also where a lot of these big Democratic groups are spending their money to try to figure out what their message should be. How do they win back voters, but also how do they improve their brand? I think one of the things we've seen in polling since the election is that the Democratic Party brand as an institution has suffered its largest losses in popularity in decades. And so they don't just have like a an economic messaging problem. They have a brand-wide problem and they know they need to fix it. And I think they're going to try to propose a lot of different ways and see which one and which candidate emerges as most successful. Mm-hmm.
And Josh, we have about a minute left. Would you like to add to that or just leave us with some final thoughts?
I think what Tyler said is right. I think the final sort of totality of the book is that, you know, the Trump campaign made a lot of shrewd choices and remade the electorate on the Republican side in some pretty drastic ways. And, you know, the Democrats have a lot of sort of soul searching to do because, you know, what happened in this election did not work for them and they lost ground among almost every group. And I think that's why we called the book What We Did and are looking forward to keep covering in the future.
Josh Dossey is an investigative reporter with The Wall Street Journal. Tyler Pager is White House correspondent with The New York Times. They're both former award-winning reporters for The Washington Post. Their new book is 2024, How Trump Retook the White House and the Democrats Lost America. Thank you both for your reporting and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. And we hope you can join us for tomorrow's media roundtable. We'll discuss the Republican Party's efforts to redraw congressional maps to tighten their grip on the House and next year's midterm elections. Then we'll discuss Gaza's deepening hunger crisis. According to the UN, Gaza's entire population is experiencing prolonged food shortages, with nearly 500,000 people facing a catastrophic situation of hunger, acute malnutrition, illness, and death. We hope you can join us tomorrow. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show today, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.
If you are blaming the theft of a small toiletry for closing essential healthcare services, you've kind of lost your way in terms of being a quote-unquote healthcare service provider.
Pharmacies are shuttering around the Bay Area. Today we hear about the middlemen who are partly to blame.
So they decide what drugs are on your list of covered drugs and what your cost sharing is and what your premium.
Then how national parks are having to make big changes.
The Department of Interior has proven themselves as unworthy to manage the National Park Service as they are attempting to dismantle it and to change the way we interpret history.
Protecting public land. Stay tuned. Cross Currents is coming up. First, this news.